Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is 4 minutes past the hour on the 14th of June, and I have good news for you yet again today. That tomb is empty. Jesus is risen, and we can continue to walk out this life with hope, regardless of the difficulties of today that are difficult, knowing that in our future, all things will be made right. So our passage this morning from Hebrews 12, let us run this race with perseverance that's marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Logan Rausch on the board. And Logan, we were talking during the break, just reflecting on Neil and Danny's conversation on summer jobs. And you were saying that you had some of the best summer job opportunities growing up and in your background. Say more about what you've done.
I can't speak highly enough of summer Bible camps. Both
summer Bible camps. For you, and you've never actually read the Bible, so was this awkward to be in the camp?
Yeah, I was very confused about this Jesus fellow, but people seem to speak very highly of him.
Well, yeah, and so that was great. So say more as you were in these camps.
Oh, my gosh. The chance for kids to get away and experience nature. I mean, the experience alone of not having your phone for a week is something that kids never get.
Absolutely.
But for a counselor to be able to speak into these kids' lives, kids never open up more. I mean, you know how closed off kids can be with parents. They just don't want to share their feelings sometimes.
Right.
But when they get to camp around kids their age, going through the same struggles they are, and a younger person who's maybe, 19, 20 years old, who's just experienced these things, for some reason they just feel like they can open up, and the Holy Spirit works in them so well. And there is just no greater faith development than summer Bible camps.
Yeah, and you talked about how at the end of those weeks, and what a great indication of enjoying the summer job, that at the end of those weeks, you were exhausted, but then energized kind of at the same time.
Oh, let me tell you, when Monday was over, I was telling the kids, we have to go to bed. I'm so tired, but it's not because I want to go to bed. It's because I need to be ready for how exciting tomorrow is going to be. There's just so much I want to do with you guys, and I need the energy to do it.
Yeah, it's great. My first summer job was working in a manufacturing facility that my father had, and it was about 145 degrees in there each day, and we were just chucking these oily and greasy and dirty parts around, listening to music I probably had no business listening to. I was being piped through the facilities, and yet I worked with some friends of mine, and those were some of the sweetest memories that we have, just throwing these parts around and getting physically exhausted, but feeling at the end of the day that we had all these parts to show for what we had done, and there was this real sense of accomplishment that set us up for life. I just can't think of something more important than having young people have summer jobs.
There's so much value in learning for the first time what hard work really is, whether it's a long day with kids working for what may be considered $1.25 an hour.
Right, absolutely.
Or in a place like that, or I know I have a friend who worked in a steel mill for his first summer job, and just that physical labor of being exhausted at the end of the day, and especially for teenagers to understand the concept of what it means to have a paycheck and then manage how they're going to spend that. It's such an important part of growth, and I really can't recommend a good summer job enough.
I love watching my 18-year-old when he has $20 in his bank account right now manage that money for the better part of a couple days. It's fabulous to watch. All right. Well, welcome to the show. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be back with Dr. David Aikman, talk about some of the main headlines of the day. Short break and be back in a minute. Minutes past the hour, you are listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we teased just before the break that we were going to have Dr. David Aikman, one of our regular guests on the line, but as is always the potential, we're trying to call through to Ireland, and we have been unable to locate him. We do know that Bill had him sort of pegged as a bit of a secret agent, so maybe we're pulling out of some spy situation. We will do our best to locate David Aikman. But in the meantime, we had an opportunity to talk with one of our regular guests in the program yesterday as well, a taped interview I did with Dr. Ann Bradley, one of our favorites here on the mornings. And we talked a lot about some of the tariffs coming up and what's been happening with the G7 and things related to North Korea. So we'll air that now and we'll keep on the hunt for Dr. David Aikman. Good morning. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined at this point by one of our favorite regular guests here, Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley of the Institute of Faith and Working Economics that comes on every couple of weeks and sort of just walks us through some of the main economic conversations that are happening globally. Ann, great to have you on the program. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So there's obviously been some pretty significant economic news relative to tariffs again, and that's been sort of this bubbling theme that's been happening over the last 6 months with the Trump administration, beginning with China and the idea that there is a national security risk relative to China robbing us of our intellectual property. How are you processing some of that, Anne, before we get into some of the more recent things with the G7? Tariffs are typically related to some sort of security risk. Is that not right?
Well, we tend to associate those two things together. And I think when we talk about tariffs, what we are referring to is a condition under which, a specific condition under which we would limit trade, where we might impose, you know, a tax, or we might limit the quantity that we allow to be imported or exported from one country to another. And so this is the ongoing situation with China. And as you mentioned, with China, we're talking about an authoritarian government. And so it gets a little bit complicated when we have, you know, these security concerns, as particularly as it relates to how China is using or stealing intellectual property, not respecting kind of the terms of intellectual property. And I think in the digital age, this becomes an issue, especially when you're dealing with a country. When we think about China, what we need to keep in mind, this is a country that's been under communist rule for quite some time and really has only had some limited experience with market trade since 1978. Now, that's a long time, but they're still new to the game. And so we kind of want to be careful with this conversation because, as you mentioned, people are concerned about national security and hacking and intellectual property and these types of things, things that we might worry about the government of China doing. But I think we also need to remember when we're talking about trade, we're not just talking government to government. We're talking people to people. And so when you go to the dollar store and you buy, you know, a brush or a toothbrush or, you know, whatever it might be, if it says made in China on it, that's a person trading with a person. So you are individually trading with someone you'll never meet, but that trading opportunity is really important for that person to experience income gains and productivity gains. So we don't just want to shut down trade because the government is behaving badly, and I think that's where it gets a little bit tricky, and we need to have a real nuanced conversation about how can we alter the terms of trade with China in a way that protects intellectual property and protects innovation and protects American consumers, but also allows the people-to-people trade that we so deeply care about.
And as part of this, too, just in terms of this national security risk with China, the idea that I've heard kicked around that we can no longer in America even manufacture at the right kind of price points some of the materials and weapons that would be used in our military, that we even have to outsource some of the manufacturing. And so we're sort of creating a big hole in our manufacturing in the States that then gets subsidized out to China. Is that part of the argument with the tariffs as well?
That tends to be part of the argument. I think, you know, one thing we need to look at is that if you look at the overall manufacturing output, so, I mean, this is all manufacturing, not just military-style goods and services, but if you look at overall manufacturing, the United States has increased its manufacturing output since 1987 by 70%, which comes as a shock to people because the line that you tend to hear is that we don't manufacture as much, we outsource more, and thus, you know, kind of are we losing jobs and, you know, are we outsourcing the production of kind of things that we want to keep at home, especially when we're talking about military goods, because there's, again, a national security aspect to that, maybe an aspect of some of those things that we want to classify. And I think what we need to keep in mind is that whenever we increase our productivity, we're going to outsource. And so everything is really outsourced. I mean, the BMW that you drive, or the Honda that you drive, or the Ford that you drive. You know, the Honda isn't just made in Japan, and the Ford isn't just made in USA, and the BMW isn't just made in Germany. These are made everywhere, and that includes planes and tanks and ammunition and these military supplies that we think of too. So it's hard to think of a product that's not outsourced. So I'm not really so worried about the outsourcing, because that's a thing that helps us be more productive. I think what we might be more concerned about is the transfer of classified or specialized military information, and that's, I think, kind of a part of what you're reading about there, which is, so I think we need to differentiate what types of goods we're talking about.
It makes sense. And it sounds like there's actually a hard, or not maybe a hard deadline, but a deadline coming up in which some of the conversation about the possibility of some pretty significant tariffs being levied on China is either going to happen or not happen towards the end of June. What are the implications if these tariffs do get levied? What do you see that's going to happen just in the common, average, everyday life of American people?
Yeah, tariffs, again, I think they are one of those things that they are a political tool that has economic implications. So they're a political tool that's directed at economic activity. And so that's where we kind of need to be careful, because tariffs tend to be retaliated against, and that's what we would call a trade war, which is what we're talking about right now with China, with Canada. So, you know, you want to be careful about these types of things, because they tend to be what we call tit-for-tat strategies. So, you know, there's a tariff levy, and then the other government responds with an in-kind tariff, and then the retaliation escalates. And what an economist would say is that trade wars tend to not help anyone. And again, I want us to think about trade not being so much government-to-government trade, and that does exist, of course. But the tariffs we're talking about are mostly tariffs that would apply to people-to-people trade. So we produce things in the United States, and we sell them, and Chinese manufacturers and international firms produce things in China and sell them globally. And the tariffs tend to raise the prices of consumer goods. So what I worry about in an escalating trade war, it's like a game of chicken. You know, kind of somebody has to fold first. And there's political collateral, I think, and reputational issues that go along with that. But I think the losers in the trade war tend to be American consumers. And who I really worry about are the people at the bottom of the income distribution. Because, frankly, people at the top, you know, they're not going to worry so much if the price of their milk or their cheese or, you know, whatever it may be, laptop, goes up. For people at the bottom, this can be significant in terms of their limited income. So we want to be careful about thinking through the consequences of a trade war. And again, it tends to be consumer prices that get hit.
It's great stuff. We're talking with Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley of the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And we'll take a short break. And when we come back, we'll transition the tariff conversation and some of the recent events of the G7 and what happened up there with our president and the Minister of Canada and milk conversations on tariff. More with Dr. Anne Bradley when we return. Welcome back. We are with Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley of the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, a regular guest here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we have been talking about tariffs, first on what has been happening with the United States and China. But more recently in the news, we see that this tariff conversation has gone into some of our historical partners and allies, as we met at the G7 summit, and quite a bit of consternation there between countries. Anne, kind of walk us through what took place.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that we're in a situation where, you know, the G7 is kind of a meeting of allies, of countries who agree to work together on a variety of different issues, including trade. And so you kind of have this blow-up between Canada and the United States, President Trump and Trudeau. And I think, you know, I can't speak to what's motivating that. I'm not entirely sure, but I think, you know, when we hear President Trump speak about it, he seems to be upset about some of the tariffs that Canada has already had in place on American consumer goods. And so kind of the thought is, I guess, from his point of view is, you know, we're going to kind of come back with tariffs that are retaliatory on Canadian goods. And again, the best way to play a trade war is not to play at all. I think that's kind of the lesson of economics, is that this stuff doesn't really help anyone. And I'm not sure how much political capital can be gained in this. I mean, some of it is a bit of grandstanding, I think, to undo some of the tariffs. So if we got rid of the existing tariffs that we already have, that would be wonderful. And frankly, the United States has had longstanding tariffs against Canadian goods as well. So these things tend to work in both directions. And so, again, I think the ideal situation would be to loosen all of these tariffs. But you have to think about things like the American dairy market. There are profound subsidies that have existed by the American government that help kind of corporate dairy farmers. And so it is a kind of complicated issue. They benefit from those. And in some way, the tariffs could unravel some of that as well, which is why the issue gets complicated.
Yeah, and how much of this is political posture? I mean, when Peter Navarro comes out and says there's a special place in hell, and I know he walked back these comments, but just the idea that tariffs and what Prime Minister Trudeau supposedly did in terms of what was considered to be a backstabbing news conference after some agreed upon things, and there's just all this rhetoric. How much of this is political posturing to ultimately come to what is perceived to be a better trade deal, and how much of it is real antagonism between these countries' leaders?
I honestly think it's a lot of grandstanding and showmanship. And, you know, I think in President Trump, we have someone who is willing to say a lot of things off the cuff. And that kind of is changing the international conversation a little bit. I think people don't know what he's going to say. And maybe the nice way to put it is he's not as diplomatic. And, you know, maybe that's not even a criticism. It's just how he is. And so I think some of that is this playing out internationally. I mean, you have to think about running a firm is very different than running a country. When you run a firm, you can just lead with your personality and you rise or fall on that. Running a country is a little bit different. It's not a profit-maximizing entity. You're not selling things. So I think that transition has been one that he's either unwilling to change or doesn't know how to. And so I think a lot of it, my own view, I could be wrong, is that it's some grandstanding, some showmanship, some, you know, I'm gonna put all this on the table and try to intimidate you. And again, both Canada and the United States fully understand the importance of this friendship, longstanding historical friendship that we have. So it's in nobody's interest to destroy that. And I think both parties understand that well. So to me, I think it's a lot of grandstanding and showmanship and, you know, kind of showing the rest of the world, like, this is what happens if you mess with us kind of thing. That's my view.
Yeah, it's so much of this is politics, and you even can take it to the other side of the conversation now. And obviously, our president has met with Kim of North Korea, and there is economic implications as part of that conversation as well, in which President Trump was indicating he would love to even see commerce opened up in North Korea, a historical enemy of ours, and even bring a McDonald's there. What have you been following relative to that story of opening up North Korea to commerce at the end of the day?
I mean, to me, this makes my heart happy because I think a couple things that I will say. We tend to group, you know, what we'll say, North Korea does this or the United States does this. In fact, I think I just said that and I should be called out on that because North Korea is just a geographical entity. It's filled with human beings, our
right.
fellow human beings, in fact. And we need to remember that. So we can, you know, despise what the leadership of North Korea, the way they behave, the way they oppress their people. But I think trade and commerce is the long-run solution. It's at least an important part of it towards individual liberty, which is what we should want for our fellow human beings. I think that's really a biblical point of view, that we want other people to be freed from the shackles of oppression and poverty. And how do you do that? I think commerce has demonstrated historically over time to be a pacifying force. So this is, Trump is absolutely right. And I actually think that free trade and opening markets in North Korea empowers ordinary people, and it actually tends to make it harder to be authoritarian. Now, this is a long-term thing. It takes time for this to play out, but I'm with him 100%. And I mean, I think the evidence of human history shows that commerce and trade liberate people. It gives people exit options to be able to flee bad situations, and it empowers people to care for their family and their community. So I couldn't be happier about that rhetoric. Now, we'll see, right? That the thing is, we have to put our money where our mouth is and do it.
That's Dr. Ann Bradley with us again from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. Just in our last minute here, Ann, as the potential for North Korea opens up, are we going to run into some tension potentially with the way sort of free market enterprise and commerce happens within China? Because obviously China has a significant amount of influence in this conversation as well. So maybe just in our last minute, talk about that tension we might end up running into.
Yeah, I think so. I think these regional forces matter a lot. And I think authoritarians need to stick together. So I think if China is looking at the writing on the wall, they might be a little worried about what's going to happen if North Korea frees up. So there will be regional issues, and they will need both economic liberation, but also really important good diplomacy. And so this is what we need to, I think, be prayerful about in the future, that we can have some diplomatic conversations about how these situations unfold. So that we can get movement in the right direction. But as you mentioned, I mean, authoritarianism is a very hard thing to undo. Look at China. They've had a lot of change in their economic freedom, but the political freedom just isn't there. And the question is, will they ever get it? So I think that is absolutely the right thing to be watching. And we need really good diplomacy and efforts to kind of, be ahead of the game in terms of how this will unfold.
And thank you, as always, for coming on, just sort of walking us through some of what can be some pretty complicated topics economically. I just appreciate your presence on the morning show and look forward to talking to you again here soon.
Thank you, Peter. Have a great day.
You too. That was my interview with Dr. Ann Bradley. We're going to take a break and go to Breakpoint, where we're going to talk about students and needing to stay in the classroom even if they disagree with the topics. Here we go. That was Breakpoint, and we'll head to our morning news. But before we do, we've got to head to the breaking news desk over there with Paul Perreault. We've had this raccoon story, and we're looking for some closure, Paul. Can you help us understand where we are in this?
Paul doesn't even know.
Paul doesn't know. I see him talking, but he came with this update. Well, Paul, we'll have to come back after news and get the story. What do we have, Paul?
No.
Oh, you got me.
Paul, give us this story. It's with bated breath over here, Paul. We're dying. What do we got with the raccoon?
Okay, just the latest on the raccoon, that he is safe now. He's the one who tried to climb, and he got to the top of the 25-story UBS tower. Well, they captured him yesterday morning, checked him out, the animal control officials. He's healthy, so they released him. They took him to the Southwest Metro, some private land here in the Twin Cities, and he's out free. Now, that's kind of the happy news. Now, the curious news is this morning I've been following traffic, and there's been lots of reports of animals on the roadways near St. Paul. It's like, okay, do we got a bunch of copycat animals?
It's always the risk when we cover the raccoon story. Let's head to news. When we come back, we'll have Dr. David Aikman, our foreign affairs expert, talk with us about North Korea.
No one makes it through life without dealing with this human emotion, loss. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. The pain that follows loss is something none of us escape. It's overwhelming when you've lost something or someone. You know what it's like to grieve a broken relationship or spend sleepless nights fretting over the loss of a dream. Well, those same painful feelings are stirred up in your teen as well. When they don't get what they want or their dreams are shattered, they experience the hollowness of disappointment. But unlike adults, teens rarely know how to express it. So keep your eyes open for grief in your teen's life, and always be ready to give them a hug. All of us need those arms of affection that remind us everything's going to be okay.
There's much more encouragement for parents from Mark Gregston online at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
19 minutes before the top of the hour, and that is the walk-up music of one of our favorite weekly guests here, Dr. David Aikman, coming to us from the British Isles. I know, Dr. Aikman, you're away for just a bit trying to sort out those last vestiges of some of your secret agent role over there. So we're glad you're joining us this morning. Good morning.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm always delighted to be on your program.
Well, I've loved listening to your take on world events. And, of course, we see the headlines of just even yesterday where apparently we've taken such steps here in North Korea that our president here in the United States has declared that there is no more risk of nuclear threat from North Korea. Did you see this headline yesterday?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think it's I haven't seen, of course, the U.S. papers, but obviously that is the claim that President Trump has made. So I wonder if there is something that was said behind the scenes that we may not know about yet, but may have been something that Trump actually picked up.
Well, and that's what everybody's covering at this moment is that there was a lot of rhetoric, but not a lot of substance in what came out of these meetings. Are there one or two takeaways from what you've seen so far that you're going to be tracking in the days ahead to just see what are steps actually being taken, or was this more of just a political show? What are you looking for in the days ahead?
Well, it was a very important symbolic political show because what it did was it put North Korea on the record as saying, we will denuclearize. And so when the Americans start to ask, well, okay, when are we doing step one, two, and three, it'll be very difficult for them to sidestep that issue. I mean, I think one of the apparent weaknesses of the agreement they both signed is that there is no timetable and really no definite markers of what constitutes an actual success. But I think that probably President Trump had some kind of understanding with Kim Jong-un that certain things needed to be done by a certain time, which would result in efforts by the United States to respond favorably. I mean, President Trump has been criticized a lot for declaring, apparently without telling the South Koreans or the Japanese in advance, that the war games that they do every year would not be repeated. And that has evoked criticism because people say, well, you shouldn't really make that commitment until you see that North Korea has done something to warrant it.
And that is the back and forth we're seeing right now is there a sense that one of them is going to blink? But even in that blinking, there's been almost this whiplash in how the two of them are speaking with one another. We've gone from this rhetoric of Rocket Man and you know, I have a bigger button than you do, to now that there's these optics and these photos of them smiling and shaking hands and the complementary nature between the two of them. What is this, again, just is this about optics, or do you see that there's a shift in the relationship?
Well, the optics are very important, but I think it's also important to remember that the South Korean government of President Lee actually played a significant role in arranging this summit. And the South Korean pressures on the North to open up the exchange of relatives and the opportunity of one side to visit the other is going to be considerable. And I think if South Korea decides that the North is really reneging on its promised commitments to relax relations with the South, and of course also to even to have a peace treaty, I think that's going to be a piece of the quiver in the armament of President Trump to say, come on, guys, you've got to start delivering on this. So it's not just limited to the nuclear mechanics of the operation.
Talking with David Aikman this morning about the ongoing developments within North Korea and the United States. And Logan and I were just chatting about just even some of the potential morality of the shift in this relationship. So Logan has a question for you this morning.
Yeah. You know, obviously in this country, there is a voice that is very loud and very critical of the president. And that comes out every time he does anything. But the question being asked right now is it okay for Donald Trump to be sort of excusing the behavior that Kim has had? Obviously, this voice is very loud, but even some Christians are asking, hey, there are Christians being persecuted in what are considered to be Auschwitz-level camps in North Korea, but Donald Trump is praising him as a great leader who cares for his people. At what level do we as Christians, should we be just kind of stomaching this, or should we be hoping that...
I think that's a valid criticism. But in fact, Trump actually addressed this issue at his post-meeting press conference and said that he had actually spoken to Kim Jong-un about these camps and the persecution of Christians. So that implies that there must be some kind of agreement by North Korea at least to lessen this or to release some of the people. And if that doesn't happen, I can be quite sure that many people in the United States are going to put pressure on the administration to force the North Koreans to do something to show that they're improving the conditions for their own people.
Take a short break. Talking with Dr. David Aikman. When we return, we'll shift the conversation to some of the headlines coming out of the British Isles, where you are, Dr. Aikman, relative to this ongoing Brexit conversation. Be back here in just a minute. Just about 10 minutes before the top of the hour, this is Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are chatting with one of our favorites again, overseas correspondent, Dr. David Aikman. And David, obviously it was a while ago that the British people voted to leave the European Union for a variety of reasons, and it all sounded great at the time, but it's clearly proving much more difficult to execute to leave the Union than it was to vote about it. So where are we in this part of the process right now?
Well, it's a very interesting point because Theresa May has to negotiate basically on two fronts. She has to negotiate as the Prime Minister of the UK with the bureaucrats of the European Union in Brussels, and she also has to negotiate with her own cabinet, some of whom are ardent Remainers and some of whom are equally ardent Brexiteers. I think she's done an extraordinarily skillful job thus far on persuading the ardent Brexiteers not to be too disruptive in cabinet meetings and to try to persuade the Remainers that she is taking into consideration all of their concerns about the economy. For example, the Remainers, those who supported Remain before the referendum, are arguing forcefully that Britain should have some kind of customs union relationship with the EU in order to forestall serious economic losses in trade. So they have been arguing that there has to be some kind of vote prior to final departure to satisfy all of the concerns of members of parliament on both sides of the leave and remain equation. And she's basically agreed to that. And it does seem to have calmed down for a moment. But now the Scottish Nationalists stormed out of parliament yesterday because one of their leading members of parliament was asked by the Speaker of the House to leave because he wouldn't sit down when he was told to. So there's a lot of disruption taking place, and if she can handle all this relatively smoothly, I think it would be an amazing achievement.
Yeah, is there any chance at this point that the vote gets overturned and that the British Union ends up staying within the European Union?
No, not at all. I don't think there's any possibility, although George Soros has been funding an organization trying to put pressure on the British government to allow a second referendum. In fact, a sort of, oops, we made a bad decision, let's do it again. I don't think there's the slightest likelihood of that, because even the Labour Party agrees that the British people voted to leave the EU. The only sticking point is what are going to be the terms of departure, and how difficult will they be for the British economy and society. And these are the sticking points currently under debate.
And maybe in our last minute or so, too, we were recently driving through Ireland about 4 months ago with my family, and we actually hadn't done that before, and we expected at some point to note the difference between Northern Ireland and Ireland proper in terms of a border there somewhere, but there was nothing there that we drove through. And I think that's part of this conversation, too, is what does the border look like between Ireland and Northern Ireland? Where do we stand with that conversation?
Well, the point is that the borderless barrier between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic was part of the Good Friday Agreement that brought an end to the troubles in Northern Ireland. But the difficulty is that the parliamentary group in Northern Ireland, which was overseeing this Good Friday Agreement, broke down. And so you don't have a valid oversight of all of the arrangements in Northern Ireland, and the Southern Irish and the Northern Irish say we absolutely do not want to go back to any border which has restrictions or checkpoints that you have to pass. We absolutely must continue with this frictionless border between the two political entities, and I think everybody is unanimous about that.
Dr. David Aitman, great to have you on the program again. Look forward to catching up next week as the events of the world are constantly shifting. Have a good weekend, and we'll chat with you next week. We'll head to break,
Thank
and we'll
you,
wrap
man.
Up the show. Minutes before the top of the hour. Great show today, Logan, having tracking down Dr. David Aitman. His insights on world events are second to none as far as I'm concerned.
Oh my gosh, did you hear over the phone? I think someone kicked down the door. He had to go back to his spy duties as soon as he was off the phone.
He did. He's got his finger on the pulse of that stuff over there. Now, I do need to revisit something with you. I got a little bit of a bone to pick with you from the start of the show. You know, we talked a little bit about soccer with Ben Johnson at the start of the 6 o'clock hour, and Ben obviously didn't like soccer. I know you do. You know I'm an NBA guy a bit. I covered the NBA for the Timberwolves for about 10 years, and you said you hate basketball. And so make the case here, Logan, about why I should stop watching basketball.
I'm so sorry. You shouldn't stop watching basketball. Do what you love, of course. But, you know, the scoring to me is almost purposeless. You know, I mean, in a soccer game, yes, I can see that people would say it's too few and far between. But in basketball, it's just the opposite problem. There's too much. You know, somebody scores a basket, and in 30 seconds, someone's going to do it again. So there's just no excitement to me to all of this constant back and forth.
So what I'm hearing you say, actually, is that all of the parents listening right now that have their kids in youth basketball should just hang it up right now. You're disparaging the parents and move into soccer. And now I will say, my son is a big soccer guy. The World Cup obviously starting today, which is why we're talking about soccer. And and I got converted. I thought it was the silliest sport in the world for most of my life. And I was even that bad parent, right, who thought my son should play the sports I want him to play versus the ones that he loved. And so I had him in baseball, but he always loved soccer. He converted me. I was standing in Scotland and watched the first 0-0 match that I thought was actually exciting.
I mean, it's such an exciting time. It's bittersweet, though, for the United States, especially going into the World Cup. I mean, the U.S. isn't in it, but so are a lot of teams that really should be. Italy won the World Cup many times, and they're not even involved this time around. So it's bittersweet, but it's an exciting time for the world to come together, because what else does the whole world come together for, putting aside religion, politics, for one big thing?
It is quite the spectacle on that. So thanks for listening again this morning. Remember, as always, that tomb is empty. Regardless of what's going on in our present circumstances, there is always hope and always future in the beautiful kingdom of Jesus. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.